trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Hey, if you are ready to engage in some wrongthink, nay, to revel in wrongthink, my friend, you have found the right place. It's just a matter of learning to think clearly and independently, which means you do not have to agree with me or any of the guests or commentators that I share on this program. I only offer the insights and the articles that I publish in my daily show notes just to get people thinking outside of the partisan box. I believe that politics has infected way too much of our public consciousness. I think too many people have been trained to believe that politics is the source of everything that matters. I beg to differ. I think there's a lot of stuff going on where you and I have great influence, but we're kind of blinded to it in the sense that we think, well, we've got to get the right person in the right office, and then we can start to make a difference. No. Politics is one facet of many facets that make up our somewhat complicated lives. And the sooner we stop spending all of our moral and spiritual energy trying to prop up political solutions, the quicker we're likely to happen on those solutions that will actually change people's lives. Yes, it's at a smaller level. It's not going to make headlines. But you got to be okay with that. Because it's the cumulative or aggregate collection of those small acts that ultimately change the world for the better. And it's something you can do wherever you happen to be standing right at this moment. So with that in mind, let's jump right in. I've become a bit of a fan of Jordan B. Peterson, just because I'm a fan of people who are unafraid to speak the truth. And, you know, some people take great pride in, well, you know, Jordan B. Peterson had a problem with, what's it, benzodiazepine? I can't remember. It's some kind of pharmaceutical drug that he became addicted to with the consequence of you can't just, you know, well, I'll stop taking it. It will kill you if you go off it, you know, too quickly. And so he went through a lot of just real difficult times. But he has been a very steady voice and possibly one of the most impactful voices of this generation. And he has great advice, like make your bed. In other words, you want to start making the world a better place? Start by making your bed. Get your own stuff together. Sort your own crud out first. Then you can start looking at ways to improve the lives of other people or to help other people get their stuff together. One of the places where he's been especially vocal has been regarding vaccine mandates. Now, my understanding is that Jordan B. Peterson actually did get the vaccine pretty early on, but he's become a very vocal critic of Justin Trudeau's mandatory vax policies in Canada because the government simply would not leave him alone. It wasn't enough for him to get the vax. You know, Peterson says, nope, they kept coming after me. And he really has been not very happy about it. Patrick Carroll, writing for the Foundation for Economic Education, has an article where Jordan Peterson calls out Justin Trudeau as Canada considers mandatory vaccination. Apparently, Quebec is already moving forward with a tax on unvaccinated citizens. Patrick Carroll says, Jordan Peterson has become an increasingly outspoken critic of COVID lockdowns and mandates in recent weeks. Using his large platform on Twitter to push back against the restrictions in Canada around the world. He's even called for civil disobedience in some cases, warning that even more freedoms could be lost if people don't stand up for their rights. Peterson wrote in a recent column for the National Post, "We are pushing the complex systems upon which we depend to their breaking point. The cure has become worse than the disease." Though Peterson has been critical of many politicians, he has been particularly disparaging of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's been an enthusiastic supporter of strict public health measures since the beginning. Peterson said recently, tagging the Prime Minister, "These mandates bring out the petty authoritarian in everyone tasked with enforcing them. Not a good practice in a free society." Now, some of his other comments to the Prime Minister have been even more pointed. So Justin Trudeau had tweeted, it's been just over a year since these doses arrived. In that time, a lot of you have done your part. Over 80% of eligible Canadians are fully vaccinated, and our vaccination rates are among the highest in the world. But we've got to keep going, so please get your shots. And Jordan B. Peterson responded, it's been over a year since a quick return to normal was promised once the vaccines arrived in Canada and were widely distributed and used. Where's normal, Justin Trudeau? Why would anyone trust you? Or why would anyone trust anything you say now? Wow. He calls out Trudeau as a flip-flop scum rat. Okay, that's name-calling, but wow. And then here's another tweet from Trudeau. If you're taking care of some last-minute Christmas shopping this week, here's something else you can do, or something else you can add to your list, a booster. If you're eligible for one but haven't gotten it yet, please do so now. And if you don't have your first or second dose, now's the time to get it. Jordan B. Peterson simply said, up yours, Justin Trudeau, seriously. You'd have to kill me first. Okay, so it's not the most diplomatic approach, but this is a guy who is followed by millions of people. And, you know, you got to think the political class is getting a little bit nervous. Life would sure be a lot easier if Jordan Peterson was either shutting up or on our side. But when he's speaking out against them, he's speaking for a lot of other people who don't have as big of a platform or as big of a footprint as he does. Now, Patrick Carroll says Peterson's ire is not without cause. COVID restrictions have been fairly strict in Canada for much of the pandemic. Many provinces have imposed more stringent measures in recent weeks in response to surging case numbers. Quebec, for instance, imposed a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. starting on December 31st. Now, this is the second time the province has imposed a curfew, the first being from January 9th to May 28th, 2021. Quebec also recently announced they would be imposing a significant tax on those who choose not to get vaccinated, citing health care costs. Ontario, for its part, reintroduced a slew of restrictions in early January that had previously been lifted. These include gathering limits, temporary closures of many businesses, mandatory remote learning for all public and private schools, and a pause on all non-emergent and non-urgent surgeries and procedures. Now, though all of these measures have significant ramifications, the pause on certain surgeries and procedures is particularly worrisome, because dying as a result of delayed care is a very real risk in Canada. And finally, in case that wasn't enough justification for Peterson's acerbic comments, we can now add another item to the list. The growing discussion about making vaccination mandatory. Though that topic has been largely considered a fringe debate up to this point, the conversation is now making its way into mainstream Canadian politics. I personally think we will get there at some point, said Canada's health minister, Jean-Yves Duclos, in early January, referring to mandatory vaccination. Not now. I don't think we are there yet, but I think discussions need to be had about mandatory vaccinations because we have to get rid of COVID-19. Now, unsurprisingly, Peterson is having none of it. He tweets out, leave us alone, Justin Trudeau. What you are doing is utterly unconscionable. This is going to cause more grief and misery than you have the courage and intelligence to imagine. Now, fortunately, Peterson's not the only one pushing back. There have been regular protests in major cities like Montreal and Toronto, and political leaders like Maxime Bernier continue to oppose the increasingly authoritarian measures being introduced. A group of Canadian lawyers has also started to protest the COVID regime more actively by signing the Free North Declaration, which outlines their concerns regarding civil liberties, vaccine passports, and the censorship of doctors, among other things. To date, the declaration has been signed by 555 lawyers and more than 81,000 concerned citizens. Now, even those who are pro-vaccine are expressing sympathy for their unvaccinated compatriots. As Norman Doig explains in his thoroughly researched essay, Needlepoints, there are many good reasons to be distrustful of the politicians and corporations that are spearheading COVID mitigation measures. So as far as the worldview behind it all, through the mandates, though those lockdowns and mandates may be severe, they're all supposedly justified in the name of public health. Now that may sound reasonable enough, but the term public health is actually a signal of sorts, one that points to the pernicious worldview underlying the entire COVID regime. This worldview goes by many names. Sometimes it's called public health. Other times it's called the public interest, the general welfare, or the common good. Now, the phrases may differ, but they're all rooted in collectivism. The idea that the group should take precedence over the rights of the individual. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, one significant problem is that the public interest doesn't actually exist. Consider the words of Ayn Rand. Quote, the common good or public interest is an undefined and undefinable concept. There is no such entity as the tribe or the public, or where the tribe or the public or society is only a number of individual men. Nothing can be good for the tribe as such. Good and value pertain only to a living organism, to an individual living organism, not to a disembodied aggregate of relationships. It's funny. There are a lot of people who really hate Ayn Rand, probably because she was so harsh about collectivism. But she's also right in this case. That's something they can't easily swat away.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Just finishing up an article here from Patrick Carroll, published on the Foundation for Economic Education's website. That would be fee.org. Yes, this is one of my primary resources for wrong thinkers. I actually have a special page on my website, Resources for Wrong Thinkers, and I would encourage you to, you know, check it out for yourself. These are some of the news aggregators and regular sites that publish numerous columns every single week that offer insight, particularly nonpartisan and non-agendized insight into current events. So we had a quote in the last segment from Ayn Rand about the common good or public interest being an undefined, undefinable concept, because really, good and value can only pertain to living individual organisms, not to disembodied aggregate relationships. So when you hear someone invoking, well, this is all for the public health, they're trying to word weasel you into a collectivist straitjacket. And Patrick Carroll says it follows. Public health doesn't exist either, which actually makes a lot of sense. Societies don't get sick. Only individuals get sick. Health is something that concerns people, not populations. So contrary to the collectivist paradigm, we're not some herd to be coddled and immunized and protected in the name of some greater good. We are individuals with rights. Now that may sound selfish, but it's really not. What's actually selfish is demanding that other people bend over backwards to accommodate your personal risk tolerance. Now he says, notably, the proper response to individual health risks is individual responsibility. Hey, that's a virtue that Jordan Peterson has popularized with his exhortation to clean your room. Now this may seem easy enough, but note the emphasis. It's not clean your neighbor's room. Nor is it force your neighbor to clean your room or force your neighbor to clean their own room. The point is to focus on the things within your own purview. Don't try to change or fix or control other people to make your life better. You know, the most ill at ease people, the people who I see who are absolutely not at peace, are the ones who haven't figured out that trying to control others will not bring them happiness. It never can bring them happiness. They're the most miserable people that I know. Got to focus on what's within your purview, just like Patrick Carroll says. And he says that might be difficult, and it may be even scary, but it's a far nobler path than the alternative, and it's one that lockdown proponents should seriously consider. Now, I want to follow this up with a question, and that is, why do so many people seem oblivious to our current loss of freedoms? Does it seem sometimes that, people are just not seeing what's right in front of our eyes? Or maybe it's, you know, it could just be that I'm imagining the whole thing. I have to allow for the possibility I could totally be wrong. But I'm consciously trying to pay attention. I'm trying to maintain situational awareness of what's going on around me. And I suspect you wouldn't be listening to this program if you weren't doing so as well. How can people fail to see what's happening? And particularly, Jeff Thomas has a great take on the boiling the frog analogy and how it applies to us today. Now, he starts with a quote from 1984 by George Orwell, which says, there was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment, how often or on what system. The thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. It was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time. But at any rate, they could plug in your wire whatever they wanted to. You had to live, did live from habit that became instinct, in the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every move was scrutinized. End quote. Well, that now famous date that Orwell chose, 1984, is actually of no real significance. He simply reversed the last two digits of the year in which he wrote the book, 1948. Orwell concerned himself less with timeline than with concept. And that concept has been chillingly accurate in its foresight, says Jeff Thomas. He says the quote above should ring alarm bells in today's world, particularly for those who live in the U.S., for the U.S. government leads the world in the development of surveillance of its people. Today, the U.S. government is in the process of completing a massive electronic surveillance network that encompasses all telephone calls, all computer-driven communication, and all banking transactions. Quite a tribute to Orwell's Big Brother. Now, he says, we have in the past predicted that the surveillance net eventually will expand to include all monetary transactions by U.S. residents, possibly through the replacement of the paper dollar by an electronic money system, allowing the U.S. government to ultimately have knowledge of every aspect of the economic activities of U.S. residents and therefore control over those activities. Now, the excuses given for such surveillance is that it's to protect America from terrorism. Now, this notion is a wonderful invention, as terrorism can be imagined to be small or large and can occur at any time, anywhere in the country. Further, if there are no actual occurrences, the government can create false flag incidents as easily and often as they are needed. So the boogeyman of terrorism is particularly useful, as terrorism is faceless. No invasion is necessary. A terrorist could be anyone. Even your next-door neighbor, and indeed, the government computers are programmed to pay especially close heed to specific words and phrases like freedom or patriotism. Should your next-door neighbor use such words in his emails? Well, he's more likely to be flagged. Now, the degree of surveillance that Orwell described in 1984 has not yet been reached, but it's not far off. Most importantly, though, the most essential aspect of its implementation has already been overcome, and that is the aspect of popular acceptance. The American people, in the main, have successfully been sold the concept that it's necessary in order to keep Americans, quote, safe from terrorism. Now, with this green light, the U.S. government is moving rapidly toward the completion of the implementation of full surveillance. And Jeff Thomas says if any American doubts that this is coming, he need only ask himself whether the present wiretaps, warrantless house raids, and TSA shakedowns would have been possible only a generation ago. He says Americans are already being conditioned to understand that if they object to these intrusions, that only makes them more suspect. Citizens are already being encouraged to report any suspicious activity they observe in their fellow citizens, or indeed even in their own families. It's almost as if 1984 had been used as a guide in creating the new USA. Now, of course, it's admittedly easy for non-Americans like Jeff Thomas, such as myself, to criticize. But he says, we lose nothing by suggesting that those who are in a country that is in a state of dramatic decline plan their exits whilst it is still possible. After all, we are not the ones who would be leaving our home, job, and possibly family members behind. We are, in fact, already comfortably settled in our own countries, countries that may actually be thriving and promising us a positive future. And he says, there's another factor that makes it easy for us. Those Americans that we do meet are generally those who have already left, who've plucked up their courage and made an exit to friendlier, more promising shores. Not surprisingly, they tend to be very positive people. Now, on the other hand, those who remain in the U.S. are surrounded by others who, at least at present, have chosen to remain. Therefore, to actually entertain the idea of escaping the oppression of an overreaching government, not to mention a collapsing economic system and perpetual warfare, is a lonely pursuit indeed. For anyone to actually raise himself up to see the forest for the trees is in itself a major feat. to actually conceive of and then plan an actual exit to greener pastures, well, that's an even greater one. Now, he says this is not to say the U.S. is alone in its deterioration toward a totalitarian state. The countries of the EU and many other of the former free world are also in decline. However, the U.S. does lead the way in its Orwellian surveillance. And at this point, the U.S. government does not even deny its surveillance. In the Orwellian tradition, they merely state that if you have nothing to hide, you do not need to fear your government. And just as in 1984, that fear is exactly the object. People who live in fear are easily controlled. They stay put and they take whatever is dished up. As Thomas Jefferson observed, when the government fears the people, that is liberty. When the people fear the government, that is tyranny.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Welcome back to the show. Just want to give a quick shout out here to the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, located in St. George, Utah. Now, this message should be of interest to anyone listening to me within the entire state of Utah, because Heather's team at Patriot Home Mortgage, of course, is an Eagle Housing lender. Her NMLS ID is 715386. And best of all, she can help you get the home loan you need without delay. From VA loans to traditional loans to reverse mortgages, even if you want to refinance your existing mortgage, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage has decades of experience and the stability and the clout to get you that loan without delay. Call her at 435-703-4522. Stop by her office at 619 South Bluff Street in St. George. It's a great time of year to be in St. George, I'll tell you that. And tell Heather and her crew thank you for being sponsors of this program. So, is a nation a society that has a soul? Ooh, there's a deep question. Probably better asked sitting around a campfire with friends, right? Well, G.K. Chesterton really thought that, yeah, that's probably the case. And I've got an article here from Jeff Minnick from Intellectual Takeout that shares some of Chesterton's wisdom to illustrate the dual and possessed personality haunting America. Now, in sensitivity to people who are dealing with loved ones who have, you know, multiple personalities or other forms of mental illness, you know, this isn't done tongue-in-cheek, ha, 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 you know, let's make fun of it. In fact, I watched a video the other day. This was a person having a conversation with herself, although she's probably going to be upset because I would be misgendering. There were two very distinct personalities in this individual, and the really creepy thing was, as she's having this conversation before her phone, her voice changes, and I mean, it legit sounded like a totally different person. One sounds very much like a young woman, and the other sounded more like an adolescent male, but it's the same person who's speaking. And they're talking about when we realized there were two of us here in this same body, and then we fell in love with each other, and I just was looking at that going, wow, that is straight-up possession. And yet, it's very trendy, too, because, hey, you know, it was all about how do we get our pronouns right when there's two of us that we have to worry about? And it's like, okay, so I guess they, them may not be so far out of the realm of possibility. But keep in mind, we're talking what looks like legit schizophrenia as opposed to, you know, you need to respect this person's existence and honor their feelings and, you know, essentially be drafted into their whatever their fantasy is. But let's apply this dual and possessed personality haunting America to our society. Jeff Minnick says, in Remembering the Right, the second volume of collected articles from Chronicles magazine on the lives and work of notable conservative teachers, writers, and philosophers, we find a piece about G.K. Chesterton. Now, reading about this man of letters, you name the genre, and Chesterton probably wrote at least one book that would qualify for membership. He says Chesterton always delights me, as do his army of aphorisms. In the case of this article, here's one that caught my eye. Quote, a nation is a society that has a soul. When a society has two souls, there is and ought to be civil war. For anything which has dual personality is certainly mad and probably possessed by devils. End quote. I'm telling you, after watching that video on Twitter of this individual having a conversation with herself, Chesterton was right. And Jeff Minnick says, given our country's divisions, Chesterton's observations offer both wisdom and a warning. Now, Minnick says most of us would agree that a properly functioning nation has a soul, a core of beliefs and customs shared by the great majority of its citizens. And of course, these vary from place to place. The souls of Russia, India, or Japan differ radically from the soul of America. But in each instance, common values bind a people together. In recent years, however, many commentators and thinkers have proclaimed the United States a house divided, a country of blue and red states increasingly separated by their stances on everything from the role of government to the relevance of the Constitution. Some have wondered whether these divisions may bring on a civil war, while others have declared we are already living in a civil Cold War. But to even raise this possibility, he says, is a step toward transforming speculation into reality. We must never hope for another civil war, as these are among the most vicious of all conflicts. But what are we to make of Chesterton's last few words, that a dual personality is certainly mad and probably possessed by devils? Now, Jeff Minnick says madness does appear to have taken hold of some Americans. In just a few short years, some in our government and schools have exchanged our ambitions to build a colorblind society for a philosophy that explicitly judges human beings by the color of their skin. Several months ago, the National School Boards Association asked the Biden administration to label the parents who were protesting school board policies as domestic terrorists. More recently, disgraced former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe backed up these claims about parents and implied that the conservative mainstream in general qualify as domestic terrorists. To make such an accusation after 74 million Americans voted for Donald Trump for president is surely a sign of mental imbalance, says Jeff Minnick. He says the COVID-19 mess of the last 2 years perhaps best illustrates this madness. The lockdowns, closed schools and churches, vaccine mandates and passports, and constant torrent of deceptions and misinformation have left a lot of us a bit wacky. But that lunacy may have infected a large segment of the population in ways rarely seen in the United States. In a controversial discussion with podcaster Joe Rogan about the damage done by the pandemic, Dr. Robert Malone, a key figure in the development of the coronavirus vaccine, stated that the fear and anxiety created by our government and mainstream media have resulted in vast numbers of Americans more than willing to exchange liberty for safety and to look for scapegoats as the latest variation of the virus spreads across the land. Malone termed this phenomenon mass formation psychosis. Though Malone has been canceled for these views, a whistleblower from Great Britain now reveals that the government deliberately undertook this technique to frighten its people into obedience. Now, we can surmise other governments around the world, including our own, followed a similar strategy. The result? We now inhabit a world of the vaxxed and unvaxxed, where the latter are regarded as selfish and evil, which brings us to the devils mentioned by Chesterton. Minnick asks, what if those who had created this COVID psychosis had other intentions besides saving lives? What if they saw themselves as high-minded gurus who know what is best for the rest of us and intended to see that we get in step and follow those guidelines to a better society? Would they see themselves as evil? Now, he says these aren't just rhetorical questions. Surely the Nazis, the Soviets, and the Maoists never thought of themselves as evil. In all three cases, they believed they were creating a new type of human being and a just society. And like all ideologues, they were as blind as Homer's Cyclops. So when our leaders castigate and shame the unvaccinated, or when they try to make terrorists out of ordinary Americans, they may believe they are promoting good in the world. Those who support them, tripping along without discernment or reason, make themselves their accomplices. Later, when they awaken from the spell cast over them, these followers might say, "We meant no harm. Our intentions were good." And their victims might throw this old adage back at them, while the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, there's another analogy that I think may apply here, and that is the question of, can you serve two masters? I particularly think of conversations I've had with some of my friends along religious lines, asking the question, why have so many churches in America chosen to fall into lockstep with government and other officials in, you know, embracing the COVID protocols implicitly, suggesting that people should get vaccinated, they should mask up, they should follow, you know, the wise advice and counsel of government leaders and scientists? And I don't have a good answer for you, other than it's pretty tough to serve two masters. And in this case, I think our masters are Caesar and Christ. At least that's what it comes down to in my life. Now, I know how I would answer that question as to which one of those deserves my allegiance. I'm just sad to see that this is unfortunately a situation that a lot of people have put themselves into. And to me, the saddest part is it seems like an unnecessary part of amount of division. I mean, there was a time when the churches in America were the voice of reason. Do you know why slavery ended? If you answer the Civil War, I want you to hold something up next to your head and then smack yourself with it, because that's not the correct answer. Abolition came about because of the tireless efforts of people from the pulpits of their churches, teaching and persuading the public that to keep another person in chattel bondage as a piece of property was ungodly and not keeping with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Yeah, there were some other events that were associated with it, but that was the dynamic that drove it.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I just want to sing the praises of one of my sponsors here for a moment. And I got to tell you, these sponsors make it possible for me to do what I do on a daily basis. Now, if you find value in this program and the information that's shared, the encouragement that's offered, however ham-fisted it may be, please let my sponsors know that you are hearing their message and tell them thank you for making it possible for me to do what I do. One of those sponsors is SewingAndQuiltingCenter.com. It's the Sewing and Quilting Center in St. George, Utah. A family-owned business. It's been in operation since 1984. Has only changed hands three times. Teresa and Eric Alsop are the owners right now, and they have everything you could possibly need in terms of sewing machines, sergers, long-arm quilting machines, embroidery machines. They service what they sell. They actually can do free pickup and delivery during January on sewing and long-arm machines that need service. They offer free delivery on all products that you purchase on their website if you live in Washington County, Utah. Even if you live in Mesquite or Cedar City, they say give them a call. They'll work out something. And they have people who teach classes, and this is cool. You buy a machine from them. So let's say you want to get into sewing. You want to learn how to make or repair your clothing. They will teach you how to do so. They offer free classes on how to use your machine. And these classes never expire. So if you want to come back and take the class again because you forgot or you just want a refresher course, you can do that. That is taking care of their customers. SewingQuiltingCenter.com. There's a link in the show notes at the Brian Hyde Show. Go show them some love. Well, it's been pretty clear that the feds are going to use January 6th as the cudgel to beat the American public into silent submission. Anything you say about, hey, should you guys be, no, January 6th, remember. Well, Judge Andrew Napolitano has a pretty solid analysis of last week's indictment of, I think it was 11 members of the Oath Keepers for the role that they allegedly played in trashing the Capitol building, rather, and trying to overthrow the American government, in the words of the feds. Now, it's interesting because Oath Keepers were considered to be, you know, kind of off limits. I mean, they've been at a lot of kind of pivotal events. Funny thing is, Ray Epps apparently was called to speak before the January 6th Select Committee and told them, I am not a Fed. To which the January 6th Committee said, okay, well, good enough. But this is the guy you can see on video multiple times telling people, we need to go into the Capitol. That's where we need to go. We need to go inside. That's where our problems are. So if he's not a Fed, man, he was missing a good opportunity. Judge Napolitano says these are perilous times, and they're made worse by the government's political reaction to lawless behavior, which is a greater threat to personal liberty than the behavior it seeks to punish. So last week, the feds obtained an indictment of 11 members of the Oath Keepers for their role in trashing the Capitol building and attempting to interfere with the functions of government on January 6, 2021. The evidence of their guilt of trashing and obstruction is manifest. The hooligans who invaded the Capitol were lawless by any rational standard. But did they really agree to overthrow the government by force? Here's the backstory. Napolitano says the history of British monarchs staying on their inherited thrones is the history of the suppression of dissent. And the favorite tool for suppression was charging dissidents with treason. Treason was whatever threatened the government's stability from the perspective of the government. So in 1535, St. Thomas More, a former Lord Chancellor of England, the precursor to the modern Prime Minister, was convicted of treason and beheaded for remaining silent when the King and Parliament commanded him to speak. Now, the punishments for treason were horrific and always included the convict's death, often preceded by his public dismemberment. The framers of the Constitution were familiar with this history and sought to prohibit its repetition in America. They did so by defining treason in the Constitution. Quote, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. End quote. Now, treason is the only crime defined in the Constitution. James Madison, who drafted the Constitution, insisted that the definition of treason be in the founding document so that neither Congress nor the President could manipulate it to their own ends, as British monarchs and parliaments had done. Not deterred by the constitutional language they'd sworn to uphold, the Federalist Congress and President John Adams crafted a substitute crime in 1798 and called it sedition. It made criminal any false, scandalous, or malicious writings against the government of the United States. Now, this was intended to suppress dissent and evade the high bar established in the Constitution for proving treason. Thus, the same generation, in some cases the same human beings that had just written in the First Amendment that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, did just that. And they used it to prosecute their political opponents, including, infamously, Representative Matthew Lyon of Vermont, who mocked President Adams' waistline. The Federalists were so accustomed to the use of this tyrannical tool that a lame duck Federalist Congress and President Adams repealed it after Thomas Jefferson was elected president. And while the Anti-Federalists were awaiting to assume control of Congress, lest it be used by the incoming government against them. Yet one of Jefferson's first acts as president was to pardon Representative Lyon. In 1918, President Woodrow Wilson offered legislation to suppress dissent during World War I, and Congress enacted it. The socialist firebrand Eugene V. Debs was convicted of sedition, a conviction upheld by the Supreme Court, for publicly denouncing the war. Wilson and his Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, ruthlessly used the Sedition Act of 1918 to suppress dissent. They prosecuted college students who sang German beer hall songs and read the Declaration of Independence aloud in public. Their theory was that the dissent dissuaded young men from registering for the draft and thus had the potential for impairing America's war effort and thus constituted sedition. The statute under which Debs and others were convicted is essentially the same statute under which the Oath Keepers were indicted last week. It also prohibits any conspiracy to overthrow the government by force. Now, a conspiracy is an agreement by two or more persons to commit a crime where at least one of those persons took a material step in furtherance of the agreement. But the essence of conspiracy consists of constitutionally protected behavior, speech, and thought. And that makes it legally dubious and practically difficult for the government to prove. The last sedition case was brought against a Michigan militia in 2010. The indictment was dismissed by a federal judge who ruled that the defendant's hateful and threatening words and outlier agreements were protected speech and did not evince a realistic plan to overthrow the government by force. Now, in the indictment against the Oath Keepers, the feds have outlined in great detail the communications among them in the months preceding January 6th. The detail is so great that the FBI must have had an undercover agent or cooperating witness embedded in the group. And this leads to a host of other problems for the government. What did the feds know, and when did they know it? How and why did they let it lead to destruction and death? I assume he's talking about Ashley Babbitt, but I could be wrong. The Oath Keepers have insisted they never intended to use violence and only wanted to make a political point, a point that the government hates. Now, Napolitano says prosecuting speech is a dangerous business. Violence is certainly not constitutionally protected, but hate speech is. As recently as 1969, a unanimous Supreme Court ruled that all innocuous speech is absolutely protected, and all speech is innocuous when there is time for more speech to rebut it. So even if the feds don't claim that the Oath Keeper defendants are somehow criminally liable for the behavior of others present at the Capitol, rather they claim that 11 persons, 11, agreed to overthrow the government by force. Now, can an agreement that's impossible to perform legally constitute a conspiracy? Napolitano says only those who hate the politics of that 11 people could seriously believe that it can. He says the government should only prosecute crimes that have caused harm, not words and ideas that it hates, for they are protected by the First Amendment that the government has sworn to uphold. Whose words and ideas will the feds prosecute next? And that is a very relevant question to be asking. Look, I don't agree with the people who were protesting in the Capitol on January 6th, at least not from the standpoint of let's barge in there and, you know, go about causing mischief. But to call it an insurrection or to suggest that, oh, it was a credible chance to overthrow the government. I mean, I know the political class was panicked because for the first time, I think they really got a taste of just how fed up members of the American public are with their antics. But boy, have they wallowed in their victimhood. Man, have they played this up for all they can about how we've got to do something about it. And of course, that means turning the sights of government and weaponizing every aspect of government possible against people like you and me, who had nothing to do with any shenanigans on January 6th, but nonetheless are very distrustful that the people in government are doing anything like they're supposed to be doing. You know, guaranteeing our God-given rights, maintaining our freedoms. Yep, we're out of step with them, and therefore that makes us a threat. We do live in dangerous times. Keep tuning in, and we'll keep an eye on things for you.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.